This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings and thanks for joining us for this September 2018 edition of Radio Astronomy. I'm Ian Todd, the magazine's staff writer, and with me today in the studio is news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Hello.
And Dave Golder, who is our production editor.
Hello.
Coming up, we'll be talking to Professor Roberto Orosei from the National Institute of Astrophysics in Rome. He'll be talking about the recent discovery of evidence of water on Mars. And we'll also be telling you our top stargazing tip for the month. And a lot has happened, really, since the last episode. We've had new moons discovered around Jupiter and the prospect of water on the Red Planet, all of which we've been kind of discussing in the office, you know, through the course of the past few weeks. But one of the things that we've kind of been talking about the past few days is the 100th anniversary of Hosts the Planets, because it's about 100 years since the piece premiered at the Queen's Hall in London, and we've got a nice feature on the history and the inspiration of the work in the September issue. But were you guys kind of familiar with the planets before we started talking about it, before it was in the magazine?
I'd heard of it because it's one of those things that's sort of like in the public consciousness, but I hadn't actually ever sat down and listened to it. So I did that, you know, I brought it up on my computer and I listened to it through from start to finish for the first time. And it's really weird because it sounds so familiar, but I've never heard it before.
Yeah, its influence is, you know, you only have to go online and go, influence the whole planets, and it's in films, obviously, but video games as well, you know. So, like, when we're playing there, I was amazed to find out. Well, actually, I kind of, on a subjective level, I knew that it was used in, or it was influenced Zelda Ocarina of Time.
Sounded familiar.
I was the same. It was kind of like, until it was actually pointed out to me, it was like, oh my God, they're right. It's Jupiter as the bringer of jollity.
Yeah.
And it's not the famous river in Jupiter, not the the rousing, you know, national anthem we never had, I know, city my country. Not that bit, but there's another more jolly bit. It's like, do, 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 do. And there's kind of, yeah, and you can hear it in some.
Yeah, it's and also, isn't it, Mars, I think, was supposed to have greatly influenced John Williams when he was writing the Star Wars soundtrack.
The Imperial Mars, definitely,
You can hear that. It's not exactly the same as some of the other bits are, but you can definitely tell.
Well, I also thought that nobody else is going to know this, but my film background, Disney's The Black Hole. I always thought the music from that was influenced by Mars as well. But I did a quick bit of research on it today, and apparently it was influenced by Saturn, which I must admit, when I was listening to Saturn, I can't hear it at all. But apparently the composer of that music, John Barry, actually used Saturn as an influence.
Mm-hmm.
Can't quite hear that one myself. I'm still going for Mars.
Yeah.
I mean, I think really throughout listening to the whole work, you kind of get inklings of different sci-fi movies and stuff. But I think it just kind of comes with romantic music from that kind of period. And I kind of get that a lot of the time when you're listening to other stuff like Tchaikovsky or Wagner, just those kind of big slushy strings and big epic.
Oh, Vaughan Williams as well.
Or you think of 2001 Space Odyssey, that's kind of an obvious...
I've got to admit, I think there is something to that. I mean, John Williams is just writing in that kind of style. So it's obvious that if you're writing about space, people are going to go, oh, it sounds a bit like Oz the Planet Stone. But there are little moments though where I think you can definitely say he was aware of it.
I do think that definitely Holst is due some royalty fees from certain people. It sounds like he's been ripped off a lot in the last couple of years.
I was going to say that. I was going to make some gag about but why hasn't anybody ever done Pluto as well, and then found out that somebody actually has.
Really?
Yeah. And also, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in the mid-2000s also apparently commissioned 4 asteroid pieces as well.
I was going to say, have they done the other bits of the asteroid belt, like Vesta and Ceres and stuff like that?
No, they've picked some weird ones for that. It was actually Osiris was one, which I had to look up and go, is there an asteroid called Osiris? So apparently, yes.
There's asteroids called
Mission.
Everything.
But then the other ones were Totartis. Tutartis? My pronunciation is terrible. and the other one is... Oh, Ceres. There is one for Ceres.
Oh, okay, cool.
But the fourth one isn't... Even though it's called The Asteroid, is all about the first person to die in a space mission, which is a cosmonaut Komarov.
I think it's a nice sort of way to remember the losses that we've had in our quest to get out into space.
Fair enough, yeah.
Mm. One of the things I thought about, I mean, as you say, it was kind of something that you're always aware of, but then I kind of properly sat down to listen to it over the last month, and just looking at the descriptions that he gives to the planets, because I wasn't originally aware that he was kind of making the astrological connection.
Mm.
So he calls Venus the bringer of peace. And thinking about what Venus is like, or what we now know Venus is like, I was thinking, peace on Venus? It's got 465 degrees Celsius, covered in volcanoes and acidic clouds, the bringer of peace.
I do think they've got Venus and Mars, sort of like the traditional views of them, the wrong way around, because Mars always seems like this, well, it's not at the moment because there's a massive dust storm going on, but it's usually like this calm, placid place where not much happens. And then Venus, where you've got, acid rainstorms and it's hot enough to melt lead.
Jupiter is jollity, but obviously Jupiter's covered in massive storms that have been raging for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But that's quite nice, actually. You were mentioning Ceres and Vesta there, because the other thing that we kind of, the other main milestone that we've been talking about this month, and which is also featured in the September issue, is the end of the Dawn mission. Jasmine Fox Skelly wrote us a feature on that. But it's been like an 11-year mission, basically, hasn't it?
From when it first took off to when it got there, it was an 11-year mission. It's one of those ones that actually, when you look at it and sort of what they tried to do at the time, it was quite spectacular, really, because it was the first mission that was going to go to and really look at not one but 2 celestial bodies. It started off at the asteroid Vesta, which is the biggest asteroid that isn't also called a dwarf planet. and then it stayed there for 2 years.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Did all of its research and then moved on to go and see Ceres, which is the largest body in the asteroid belt. I think it takes up a third of the mass of the asteroid belt is just Ceres. And that one's, big enough and ugly enough to get itself into a sphere, so we call it a dwarf planet.
Cool.
Yeah, because it's part of my job. You won't believe the amount of time we spent last month going about the main cover line of the issue, like going, can we still call it an asteroid? Is that okay? And apparently, yes, we are still okay by certain classifications to call it an asteroid. So if you do any I think you'll find on us, we'll come back with it. I think you'll find on you.
I think kind of one of the things that really blew my mind about the mission was the idea that Ceres, at one stage in its distant past, had a global ocean. Mm. You know, it's kind of stuff like, because you do look at it and think, well, that's kind of just, it's a lifeless body, but it's, yeah. I suppose that's the importance of these missions, really, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's you sort of think about, you know, like the hunt for life going all over the solar system, and you're sort of going to these moons and stuff, but you always think of these asteroids as these dead worlds where nothing happens. And actually, one of the things that Dawn found at Ceres was the fact that it has an active cryovolcano called Ohuna Mons. Mm-hmm. And so that's volcanism where instead of rock flowing as lava, it's water ice and water. And it's, you know, you think of these, as I said, as being cold, dead worlds where nothing happens, but they're not. They're actually really interesting to study.
They're quite dynamic in their own way.
Yeah, aren't they? I know.
Yeah, I suppose that one of the main things that kind of maybe sticks in people's minds is the shiny spots and the Okator crater in Ceres.
Yeah.
Just, I suppose, because I looked at a picture of, just going back to Vesta, I looked at a picture of what we knew Vesta looked like, and it was, I think it was from Hubble images, and it's just this kind of round, you know, smooth sphere, and then I compared it with a picture of what we now know it looks like, and it's like covered in craters, and, you know, it's just cool that these missions just bring these bodies closer to us.
Yeah.
But you're missing the most important thing, which is that Vesta has got some craters that look like a snowman. If it's not actually officially ever called the snowman, we're going to be really disappointed.
That is how a lot of things get named, which is just the people in the office decide to call them something silly and the name kind of sticks, and then eventually the International Astronomical Union kind of just go, well, everybody calls it that anyway, so fine, we'll have a Mount Doom on Titan. You win.
Frosty McFrostface, then, it'll be.
Yeah, I mean, if they put it out, that's what it would be. Wouldn't it be? Frosty McSnowman. But yeah, speaking of water, as I said earlier on, one of the big stories this month was kind of tantalising evidence that there might be water on the below the surface of Mars. And Ezzy, you've been finding out about that?
Yes. So this was one of those stories that sort of kind of caught the public imagination a bit, because we've been looking for water on Mars for years. Pretty much every mission that's gone and landed on the surface, and most of the ones that have been in orbit as well, that's one of the things they've been looking for. We've known for years that there's evidence of past water on Mars, and we can see it in that there's various rocks and minerals that could only have formed if there's water around. Not to mention the fact that, you know, you can see rivers and deltas and things like that. But this one is particularly interesting because Mars Express thinks they found an actual, it's more of a puddle or a pond than an underground lake. But they've found water, or they think they found water, about a kilometre underground. And I actually talked to the main person who made this discovery, Roberto Orosei, from the National Institute of Astrophysics in Rome.
So, Roberto, could you tell me a little bit about what exactly it was that Mars Express uncovered at the Red Planet?
We have been analysing data acquired from the MARSIS radar, and we detected very strong echoes coming from 1.5 kilometers below the surface of the South Polar Cap. These very strong echoes are even stronger than surface radar echoes. And they point to the presence of liquid water, which is the natural material that best reflects radar waves.
So how certain are you that this is actually water? Could it be anything else?
We have been working on this for several years, in fact, and the last 2 years were spent just trying to examine any other possibility. We have been doing a lot of analysis, numerical modeling, and a lot of discussion. And we eventually were able to conclude that the most plausible explanation for the data, for the observations we have, and for their properties, was the presence of liquid water. And so essentially we go by exclusion. It's the alternative explanations that we could think of essentially do not provide a clear do not connect well with the data. If there was something else that was somehow, for example, producing strange reflectors into the ice, like a sort of, let's say, mirror effect due to cracks and voids and anything like that, that would not be observable from many points of view, but we have at least 9 observations over the same area, and they all provide the same result. There are very strong ecos there. And that's essentially the main reason why we became convinced that there must be a high reflectivity medium there, and the only natural material to do that is water.
So whereabouts precisely is this water that you are finding on Mars?
It's a body of water about 20 kilometers across, essentially because all of the energy of the radar pulse gets reflected by the surface of the water. So we don't get to have enough radar eco power into the lake and back to us. But we know that liquid water must be of the order of about 1 meter thick. Otherwise, the radar would not be able to see it. So this is still a lot of water.
When you say it's 1 meter thick, could it be deeper, or is it that's sort of about what you think it is?
We have no indication of the possible depth, so it could be anything. We, in fact, expect it to be at least of that of the order of a few meters. It would be unlikely to have just a simple, such a very thin layer distributed over such a large area.
So this is going to be quite far down under the ice. Do you think we'll ever be able to sort of get there and look at this water ourselves directly?
This is an extremely complex technological challenge, and it will be also a matter of budget to do that. We have problems digging into subglacial lakes on Earth, like the very famous Lake Vostok in Antarctica, because of their depth and the difficulty of digging through ice. So there will be problems to solve, but eventually we will be able to get there.
What kind of water do you think you'll be finding down there? Sort of, I have visions of these great aquifers underground, but I don't think that's actually what it would be like.
We know that the water there contains salts. And this is something we deduce from the properties of the radar signal, which is so strong that it requires very transparent ice above it. And ice is very transparent when it's well below the freezing point. So even the water in contact with it must be below the freezing point, and this requires the presence of salts. So this means that we are seeing an environment that reminds of certain hypersaline subglacial lakes, like the one that was discovered in the Canadian Arctic recently this year. And those environments are considered viable for life, even if they are very difficult for normal terrestrial life. But we know that there are microorganisms that could survive in such an environment. So this is something that we are hoping to explore, and we are very eager to look into, but we have only few ideas what it could be like.
And so you mentioned there that life could survive potentially in these lakes. What do you think this discovery has changed and affected people's views on the chances of finding life on Mars?
The main significance of this discovery is the possibility that a viable habitat for life exists now on Mars. We know that this liquid water is below freezing point, is highly saline, but we know also that there are terrestrial bacteria that would be capable of living in such an environment. So in principle, for the limited information we have on the characteristics of the subglacial water, we could transplant terrestrial life on Mars and expect it to prosper. Now, this is important because the past of Mars, we know, was very different from the present. Mars was 3.5 billion years ago, was a temperate planet. And that was maintained at a temperature well above the current one by a greenhouse effect produced by a dense CO2 atmosphere. The problem is that Mars was small enough, too small to maintain this atmosphere that slowly faded into space. But there was enough time for life to emerge on Mars. At least that's the same time was available on Earth, and that was the time in which life already existed on Earth, a few hundred million years. So the question, the big question is was could life evolve also on Mars, given that conditions were similar, the environment and the chemistry was similar, and essentially all the ingredients that were on Earth existed also on Mars? That's the big question that this discovery might help answering. So if life existed, developed, then it might have survived to this day thanks to environments such as subglacial lakes or water bodies of water. And the main reasons so for this discovery to be important is that it raises hopes to be able to determine the answer of this question: has life ever arisen on Mars?
That was Professor Roberto Orsay from the National Institute of Astrophysics in Rome. And now, Dave, you're going to tell us what we can see in the night sky this month?
Well, as ever, there's loads to see, and you can find out all about the specific details in our September issue. But for a couple of highlights, for those of you who like a challenge, Neptune will be at opposition on the 7th of September. Since a planet in opposition is nearer to Earth than at any other time, this usually means it's bigger and brighter, and so easier to observe. But with Neptune so distant, around about 4.5 billion kilometres away, the difference is so small, that's not really much of an advantage. So why mention it? Well, as our Imaging the Ice Giants feature in the September issue points out, over the next few years in the UK, there are going to be lean times for observing and photographing the usual suspects. Mars, Saturn and Jupiter will all reach opposition south of the equator, and when they are visible, they'll be mostly low on the horizon, affected by atmospheric blur. So now would be a good time to start taking advantage of the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, which will remain much higher in the sky. Our feature gives you some brilliant hints on how to photograph the pair, and it's worth having a go because, as the Royal Observatory Greenwich points out, a photograph of Neptune has never been shortlisted in the Insight Investment Astronomy Photographer of the Year competition before. However, if you want things a bit easier, there are two comets to look out for this month. You will need a telescope to see 46P Wirtanen as it travels from Cetus to Fornax in September. But 21P Giacobini-Zinna should be a brighter binocular object as it reaches perihelion on the 10th of September, just south of Auriga, next to M37.
Okay. So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about the prospect of water on Mars and what to see in the night sky in the September issue of BBC Sky Night magazine, in which we also look at how to strike colour balance in astrophotos, find out the best dark sky places to visit in Portugal, and Professor Lucy Green writes about a new European mission to send a spacecraft to study the sun. Not to mention our regular sections helping you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. Until next time, it's goodbye from all of us here at BBC Sky Night Magazine.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night Magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.